If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe at lifebetweenthevines.com.
I have never produced a vintage that I think is bad wine. They're just different.
We are farmers, and in order for us to make it, we have to be able to sell the products that we produce.
For better or for worse, I've learned by usually making mistakes and then just trying not to make them a second time.
So for us, you know, the central thing is the fruit, and it's what's given by the vineyard.
It all starts in the vineyard, as we've all heard that, right?
So drink a lot and drink well. That would be my advice.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 397. This week we feature Michel DeFeo, president of Laurent Perrier, U.S. Is it the bubbles that make champagne rise to the top of wine lists everywhere? Champagne has gone far beyond the drink of celebration to become an everyday favorite. Michel DeFeo has been immersed in the bubbles business for a good long time and loves every minute of it. Michel is president of Laurent Perrier US, and we spoke with her from her office in New York just last week to learn more about this magical beverage. While these are very special wines, enjoying champagne should be a daily celebration of life, don't you think? You can also hear Michel on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term confusion sexuelle. So by phone today, we are on the line with Michel DeFeo, president of Champagne Laurent Perrier US.
Bonjour, I'm doing great today. How about yourself?
Good. You know, I was going to say bonjour and I didn't. I'm so ashamed of myself. But you
go
said
right
it.
Ahead, Seth. You can say it now. It's still a good day.
Bonjour. So welcome to the program. Again, we're doing phone interviews these days because we can't meet in person, which is very sad, but it's fun to meet you and definitely an honor, to be quite honest, because, of course, your bubbles are fantastic and well-loved and well-known.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be with you speaking about them. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. My pleasure. Let's start off and talk a little bit about you. I know you spent some time in France. You were in the Loire Valley, if I'm not mistaken, but let's go back to before that. Your wine journey, your personal wine journey, I'm sure you probably get asked this a lot, but was there a moment where all of a sudden wine was it for you? You thought, this is something I need to really get more into.
Sure. So I grew up in New Jersey and I didn't grow up in a family that drank wine, but I did happen to see the Eiffel Tower on TV one day, and that started, I was about 8 or 9 years old, that started a lifelong passion for France. And I was a huge Francophile. I majored in French. So that led me to eventually become a translator at a bank, and then I was working in banking, but it just didn't really grab me. So I wanted to do something different, and something really was connected to France. And I ended up getting a job as an admin assistant for a champagne company. And from that point on, I mean, there's nothing more quintessentially French than champagne and wine and food, and I just fell completely in love with it, and that's been almost 25 years now that I've been in this business, and I can't imagine leaving it.
Where are you from originally?
The northwest corner of New Jersey.
Oh, well, of course. There you go.
Yeah. So not too far where now our offices now are in New York City, but I've lived in near Napa Valley and lived in France for a little bit, but back in New York and not too far from the family, which is always nice, especially at times like these.
Now, I'll bet. Considering your career and what you've done to this point, have you had the opportunity? Have you worked in the cellar? Have you been in the vineyards? Have you done any of that to kind of turn your hands purple?
Yes, in the harvest of the year 2000. And that was enough, and I did not last long. And even then, when I was quite a bit younger, I basically said, okay, you've broken me. I get it. I can't do this anymore. I was harvesting, and I think I was picking decent enough quality grapes. But boy, those things are heavy, and all of the stooping, and it's really, really tough work. So then I decided, like, you know what? I'm just going to observe the rest of the harvest. So my attempt to actually work in the vineyard and to work harvesting grapes was an unmitigated failure. So I learned my lesson, and I've experienced every level of the process, and I actually, I mentioned when I went to California, I had designs on perhaps I would become a winemaker. I thought that was so interesting. And just the more that I learned about it, the more respect I had for how extraordinarily difficult it is. And then when you do something like that in Champagne and you need the experience of so many years of tasting Van Clair to see how they will develop, I just said, okay, I'm going to leave this to the experts, and I'm going to stick to my lane on this one. So huge amount of respect, but they do it a lot better than I do.
Well, the best thing about it is you got that experience and you know what goes on behind the curtain, right?
Yes. And, you know, that's, I guess, just kind of the person that I am. I like to try everything myself. And I have really, even within my career in the wine business, as I mentioned, I was an admin. And then to learn more about wine, I actually became a teacher's assistant at the International Wine School in New York, which basically meant that I would pour all the wines for the students and then clean up all of the spit buckets afterwards. So I can't even look at Carr's water crackers. You know, I've seen so many of them floating in buckets of spill. But I literally got my hands dirty with that part of it, and then I was able to learn in those classes that I was in TAing. And at the same time, I also took a job at a wine retailer. So I was selling wine on a retail floor and stocking the shelves. So I like the fact that I've started at the bottom and I've tried things and I've gotten my hands dirty, because it's really allowed me to understand this business in a really deep way. Everything from, you know, production, I wish I could have had more, but I certainly am, at least I tried. And everything to getting that wine into the hands of someone who's really going to enjoy it. So it's good to have all of that experience along the chain.
I agree, wholeheartedly, especially the retail experience too, because you're getting to see other sides and you get to see what people are looking for, what they're not looking for, that sort of thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. And to be honest, that was really one of the most fun jobs that I've ever had. It's difficult work for sure, but I'll never forget. I had a customer came in, and again, this is like the mid to late 90s, so wine prices were a little different then. But she came in, and I was working the floor, and she said that she was having some friends over, and she told me what she was going to be having for dinner. She wanted a wine recommendation that was under $7. And it's like, okay, well, I recommended a Gato Negro Chilean Malbec, Argentinian, I'm sorry. And the next week she came back and she said, oh my God, my friends were just, they couldn't stop talking about the wine. She was so excited. And then every week she came back and she wanted a recommendation for me. And I just, and you know, obviously it was not an expensive wine, but she was so happy because she had given her friends an experience that was memorable and fun to them. And I thought, wow, this isn't just about selling a bottle. This is about the experience that someone's going to have when they pop the cork. And everything that's around that, and the social environment that they're in, and the food that they're eating, and it's a wonderful feeling to be part of improving people's days. And I really do think that that's what wine and certainly what champagne does as well.
That's a great story. Yeah, it's fun to be able to turn people on to different wines. So when you were in France, were you in Champagne at any time? Did you have a chance to sort of check those wineries out?
Sure. I've been going now back to Champagne, oh gosh, it's about 3.5 dozen times, roughly, that I've been able to go over there and spend some time. And I have spent time in our vineyards with our vineyard manager, who, you know, at LP, we own about 10% of our production every year. And then we also work with various grape growers. We have 90% of our grape needs are coming in through long-term grape growing contracts. So I've also been able to spend time with our vineyard manager, who works with those growers, and spend time with some of those growers, not only in their vineyards, but also in their wineries. And I actually, this is the fourth Champagne house that I've worked for. So I've actually been able to go to Champagne and experience many different wineries very closely, because I was part of that family that owns that winery. But I also, almost every time I go, or at least once a year, I make sure to go visit some other house. And I've visited everything from tiny little RMs to, I've also visited the largest houses, just to have that experience. What are they telling people about Champagne? How do they approach it? What can I learn? And I'm still, after all of these years in this business, every time I go to Champagne, I learn something new. And also, every time I go, I bring back a suitcase full of chalk, which, let me tell you, it seems like no matter how many times you wrap that chalk in a plastic bag, that dust still gets all over your clothes by the time you get back to the stage.
Oh, I'll bet. What a great experience to be able to go over there and spend time. I think the one thing, though, that's changing, and tell me if you agree with me on this, is that champagne and sparkling wine in general is becoming much more accepted in the United States. Is that a fair thing to say?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that we've really seen the sticking power of champagne in the last 5 months.
Really?
Where, you know, certainly the market has been growing. The market was, we were hitting... You know, last year we hit a record level of bottles imported into the U.S. pre-pandemic, But to be very honest, I mean, given the price point of champagne, because it is a very expensive wine to make, and because of its inextricable link with celebration in so many people's minds, I was really concerned about how is this going to affect us. Now, you know, champagne and LP, we've been around since 1812, and in 208 years, we've seen lots of horrible things: World War I, World War II, the Great Depression, phylloxera in the vineyards. And we've survived. And I thought, okay, we'll survive, but what is this going to look like here in the U.S. right now? And champagne sales are, at least in the off-premise, of course, are significantly up, meaning in stores. So it really spoke to how much people really do want champagne, true French champagne, as part of their lives. It's not just happenstance. If they go into a restaurant, they'll order a glass, you know, because it's there and because it's just been suggested. They're actively seeking it out, and they're making sure that they're still drinking it at home. And that's a good feeling, that people really do love champagne, and it's not just something that they happen to get at a wedding or, you know, or at a restaurant.
Yeah, I think that's a sort of I like to see it as a bit of a myth of the past, because it is becoming an everyday thing. And it's a great palate cleanser before a meal. It's a wonderful way to finish up a meal. But what I'm seeing, more men are beginning to open their eyes up to champagne.
You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right. And I don't have any statistics that I can cite, but you know, anecdotally and having observed the market for all of these years, there is absolutely no question that it has become completely acceptable, to say the least, for men to drink champagne, whereas before it was certainly considered more of a feminine drink. And we're even seeing that in rosé. So you probably have heard of the brosé trend. Yeah. And Laurent Perrier's rosé has really benefited from that as well. And it's kind of funny because I first started working for Laurent Perrier in 1998, so I've seen quite a progression. I left for a bit and worked for a couple other champagne houses, but I came back about 10 years ago. But if I think about way back when, around the turn of the millennium, and we were selling rosé, it's 100% Pinot Noir, and it's made by this direct skin maceration process, so it's very intense, and it has a lot of Pinot Noir varietal characteristic. And what I would say to people is, you know, it's pink, but it's like a really burly, you know, muscular guy who happens to be wearing a pink polo shirt. This is a masculine wine. And so it took about 20 years, you know, maybe 15, for that to kind of catch on. But certainly now we're seeing lots of men drinking rosé champagne with no fear. And that is a beautiful thing to see, for sure, because, again, they're wonderful wines. It's not just champagne, right? Champagne is called the wine of kings and the king of wine. And it really is. And like you said, it's so versatile before, during, after the meal. These days, maybe even instead of, depending on the news of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is kind of a mood elevator too, which I think everyone can need. And I think what's kind of driving some of the trends, the very positive trends that we're seeing in people purchasing champagne in stores to have at home, is that it, unlike or more than any other beverage, or even maybe or any other kind of food too, it's almost like a little vacation in a glass. It feels good. It feels like a special moment of pleasure. And our chef de cave calls our wines vins de plaisir, wines of pleasure. And we all need let's just have a moment of pleasure just in my glass. That might be the only one I get today.
That's very good. Very well said. And it's true. It does lighten the mood. I agree. Rosé is very popular. It's nice to see so many wines being accepted like this, I think, in general. But I want to talk about the grapes. You brought up, obviously, Pinot Noir, and they're usually traditionally three grapes in champagne. And if we could just talk about those for our audience to understand them a bit.
Sure, absolutely. The 99-point-something% of all of the vineyards in Champagne are planted to two red grapes and one white grape. And the two red grapes are Pinot Noir, which everyone's quite familiar with here in the U.S. It's oftentimes bottled and vinified as a single variety wine. And then the other one is called Meunier, M-E-U-N-I-E-R. And Meunier is another red grape that it's very rare to see. Actually, there is very little of it grown outside of Champagne. And each of those is Pinot Noir is like in the high 30s of the percentage of the vineyard land, and then Meunier is about 40%. But Chardonnay, which is the one white grape, which, again, everyone's probably quite familiar with, Chardonnay is actually the least planted and the most expensive grape in Champagne, at just a little over 30% of the vineyard land. We use all of those grapes. We don't use much Meunier. Meunier it can be nice and floral when it's young. When it gets a little older, sometimes it can veer towards more of like a meaty, earthy kind of flavor profile. And the wines of Laurent Perrier are just really about like this freshness and this elegance. So we don't tend to use much Meunier, especially because we age our champagnes longer than others would normally age them in the cellars. And we don't like how the Meunier shows after too much aging. For the rosé, so usually we'll blend those wines. And we have a number of our wines that are Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, about half-half. But then we have a couple of outliers. As I mentioned, our rosé is 100% Pinot Noir. And then we also make a Blanc de Blanc, which is 100% Chardonnay. And that's actually a Brut Nature. That one has no sugar added. So that's actually the newest addition to our portfolio that we just released last year.
So for our listeners, again, what makes a Pinot Noir stand out? What is, you know, I'm the grape over here and I'd like to be in Champagne, but I've been chosen to go in a still wine. How does that turn out?
Well, there actually are some still wines from Pinot Noir and Chardonnay that have been made in Champagne. We actually used to make them as well. And that's part of those are called Coteau Champenois. And they're beautiful wines if you ever get a chance to taste them, but they tend to be lighter in style because in Champagne we are one of the most northerly growing regions in the world, which means that we don't get the kind of extended sun and heat that you get in other places. So the grapes tend to be higher acid when the wines are made. So they've got low pH at the time of being picked. They're also not just, you know, huge flavor bombs, right? They're very restrained. So even the Coteau Champenois, they're beautiful, but they're very light, very, very light. And in each growing region, there's also three main growing regions in Champagne, and the Montagne de Reims is where you would find mostly Pinot Noir planted. It tends to do really well in those soils. And then you've got the Marne Valley, which is largely Meunier. And then the Côte des Blancs is a very chalk soil, super bright. Just think of like the chalk that you would use to write on a blackboard in a school. That is literally what the soil in Champagne is like, and especially in the Côte des Blancs. And that's where you'll find the Chardonnay. So it's a specific grape planted in a specific area to a specific soil type. And there's a couple of exceptions where you'll find those soils in other areas of Champagne. There's an area for much further south from those three main regions I mentioned called Mongeux, which is known for its Chardonnay. But still within that whole region, those are the three grapes. And we select, and that's really the art of the blend. And it's the art of knowing not just where to blend or which grapes to blend, but it's blending the specific crus, the specific villages. So there are only 17 Grand Cru villages in Champagne, and so Grand Cru is 100% quality rating by this kind of heritage system that exists in Champagne called the Echelle de Cru. And out of those 17, we, for our particular Pinot Noir that we want to pick that will go into our rosé, we only use 10 of those Grand Cru villages because of the particular flavor characteristics. And that's kind of a neat thing about Champagne is that we can go to those 10 villages. I mean, for our non-vintage Brut, La Cuvée, we use over 100 villages. And in Badrin or Rose, and we blend those all together. And the point of doing that is that you'll get consistency year after year. And you need to blend from various parts and various crews and various villages because for many, many years in Champagne, we suffered from issues of, you know, we still do. We still have hail sometimes, and, you know, you want to be able to mitigate that so that you get something that always tastes the same year after year. And because we do that, most champagnes are non-vintage. And it doesn't mean they're a lower quality. It just means that they're the same quality one year after another, and we have to blend in order to do that. Again, not just the grapes, but the villages as well.
It's a fascinating process. So here's my silly question for the day.
Sure.
I'm sure you've never been asked this before, but do you saber?
Depends on who's listening to my answer. The people that tend to like sabering the least tend to be the French. And, you know, there is a little bit of concern where it's like, oh, my gosh, you're wasting champagne. So point well taken, but it's so fun. I do it all the time. And, in fact, in our office here, we have kind of like a loft office in where we can store some wine. And so we've got a good amount of space. And whenever anyone comes over to our office for the first time and we're going to be enjoying a glass of champagne with them, we always make them, we teach them how to saber.
Wow.
And then we have them sign the bottle. They get to keep the cap with the cork and the glass around it, and then we keep the bottle with their signature on it. So, and not only do I love sabering myself, I love teaching people how to saber too.
That's fantastic.
And it's, again, it's like an excuse to have fun.
Yeah.
And in that same way that just having an effervescent glass of bubbly at the end of the day, and it's like, this is a good feeling. It's also a good feeling to have fun and come to our office for a meeting and people are greeted with champagne and sabering. It's like, hey, it's a great way to just inject some fun times in a life, for sure.
I agree.
I do miss that. As I'm saying all that, I'm just realizing I also feel a tinge of mourning for the fact that I don't have guests coming to the office anymore. Alas.
Yeah, it's tough.
It will happen again.
It definitely will happen again, and you know, many of us look forward to that just to be able to do tastings with other people.
Sure.
So if I come to New York, will you teach me to saber?
Absolutely.
I've never done it, believe it or not.
Absolutely.
I wanted to, but
I've
been around it a billion times. I just don't have the guts, so I don't want to I don't want to waste the juice. It's just too precious.
Well, I'll teach you next time you come to New York, because I don't think I could teach it at a distance. I think there's some things you just can't do on Zoom, and I think that's one of them.
Yeah, that would probably be a mess, more likely, or somebody would get hurt, is my guess.
Exactly.
So, you know, obviously you've spent a great deal of time in this business. Clearly you have a passion for it, and I'm sure you've done quite a bit of media. So my question here is, for those times you have done interviews, what is the one question that you've not been asked that you would really like to be asked?
That one, no. Well, I suppose, you know, it's funny. I guess I don't know that this is going to be of any interest to anyone. No one, maybe that's why no one ever asks it. But, you know, of course, I speak lots about our wines and about how wonderful they are. But I normally don't get to speak about, no one asks me about, what is it like to actually, you know, everyone knows and wants to understand what happens in the vineyard. Everyone's super interested in what happens to the point at which that bottle is labeled and it's ready to go. And then there's all of these really fascinating things that need to happen, not from a viticultural or vinicultural standpoint, but the vast majority of my job is taking that finished bottle from champagne and making sure that someone who's going to love that bottle pops that cork. And that's what me and my company do. That's what Laurent Perrier US does. So we work from everything from, you know, the process of getting things into the market, especially because of Prohibition, there's so many steps from, you know, the ocean freight and the warehousing, or the inland freight and the warehousing, and then the selling to the distributors. And there's so many people that are involved along this whole chain in order to get that bottle into someone's hand. And I suppose the reason that popped into my head as the thing that I wish I talked about more is because that's what we're really concerned about in the wine industry, because of the tariffs that have been imposed. And just last night, we learned that the United States Trade Representative announced we were expecting a potential expansion of the tariffs. We feared it. Currently, champagne is not tariffed. We escaped as champagne, but the remainder of the remainder of wines, basically from Germany, France, the UK, and Spain, are still subject to a 25% tariff now based on the value of the wine. And this is hurting everybody along that entire chain. And I just wish everybody understood that and understood the impact on the jobs and how hard everybody works to get that bottle into a store or on a table in a restaurant, because it takes a lot of people to believe in those wines to get them all the way into someone's mouth, ultimately. And a lot of those people are suffering because of these terrible tariffs.
That was a very good answer. Thank you very much.
Thanks. It's a great question.
Thank you. How did champagne manage to escape being hit with tariffs?
Wow, I wish I knew, because we haven't been hit with the tariffs, I am working as much as I can, as are people on my team. We are writing our Congress people. We are we're pushing people and ourselves. We're posting public comments and private comments that we're sending to the U.S. Trade Rep's office, because we fear it all the time, and we don't know. This has been going on for over a year. And we have been subject to, this is now four different times of potential tariffication, shall we say. And we don't know. Nobody knows the logic. It's not shared with anyone. So what that means, even though every time the announcement is made and we are not directly tariffed, what unfortunately the reality of the situation is that I have to prepare every single time that we may be.
Sure.
And that means carrying larger inventory, which means spending much more money in warehousing, that I have sacrificed hiring two people because of my expenses in warehousing. So it seriously impacts our ability to do all kinds of things. And I still have to do that because in 6 months, we are up for potential tariffs again. We are on what's called the carousel in this particular Airbus-Boeing dispute. And I don't know why Champagne keeps getting a pass. There have certainly been some people who have their theories, but they're not worth repeating because none of them have any evidence.
Sure.
And I have no idea if they are true or not. But believe me, if I had any magic knowledge is that this that we were exempt for some of the reasons that people suggest, I wouldn't be working so hard trying to prevent them from happening in the first place, and trying to figure out what to do about it if it does. So
sure, and I'm sure it keeps your stomach churning from time to time. That's not helpful.
It does, and unfortunately, it's not just the products that receive the tariffs that are impacted because we work with distributors. And, the distributors need a robust portfolio, and they need to be making money because the better off they are, the more able they are able to represent our champagnes. And, of course, with the way that the market is right now with the tragedy of restaurants, the finer the wine, the larger the chances are that they do a majority of their business in restaurants.
Sure.
And there are some distributors that do upwards of 40% of their business. So now not only are they not doing that 40% of their business with restaurants, now they're also having their profit margins shaved because they're trying to absorb some of this tariff. So the tariff along the way doesn't hurt anyone in Europe. The tariff is simply paid by an American importer, and then it is the importer and the distributor who makes a smaller margin and possibly the retailer that makes a smaller margin. And if at any point along that chain the margin is not absorbed by an American company, then it's simply passed through to the consumer who essentially is paying that as a tax. So that's just not good for anyone.
Thank you for saying that because it's a drag. This whole tariff thing is a big joke. You may have already answered this, but we can go either positive or negative on this particular question. Is what makes you crazy about the wine business?
Well, I suppose that, feeling like a grumpy old lady. I'm going to sound like a boomer, although I'm Gen X. I'm going to sound real boomer here with what I'm about to say. But even after having so many years of experience in the business, there always has been a certain segment of people within the industry that think they know more than you do. And you know what? They probably do. There is so much to know about wine. But there is always a sliver of people, and I will admit they tend to be possibly buyers, either in a store or in a restaurant. And when you're talking to them about your wines, they always want to try to play dump the sales rep.
Yes.
It's like they just have to keep asking until they find something you don't know.
Sure.
And it's like, look, I'm not here to challenge your knowledge. Yeah, you probably do know more than I do. I've only been doing this for 25 years, and I'm a certified sommelier, but I am absolutely sure that, and they'll say something like, have you ever had Bob J. Smith the Fourth, just the most obscure thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, that sounds really interesting. And some people will be like, oh my gosh, it's so cool. You have to seek it out. Here, I'll write it down for you. It's like, you really got to look into it. And then there's that small sliver that will simply go, ew, you don't know that. Like, all right, you win.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate. But I think that's really an outgrowth of the fact that it does take a lot of effort to know about wine, right? We talk about various certifications, but there's a lot of studying that needs to take place to get kind of anywhere in this business, really. There's a lot to learn, and every year it changes with every vintage. So I think that some people just are like, look, I've gone through all this effort to learn all this stuff. I'm gonna show off that knowledge. But,
sure. Well, I think it's the more you learn, the more you really don't know, I guess, in many cases.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Which keeps it fascinating.
I'd agree. Michelle, this has been a lot of fun talking to you. You're very lucky, I have to say, for what you do for a living, working with Champagne and Laurent Perrier. It's not a bad gig, is it?
Oh, no, it's wonderful. I thank my lucky stars every day.
Well, Michelle, most importantly, for our listeners who would like to learn about you and Champagne Laurent Perrier, how would they learn about you online? What is your website?
We are at laurentperrier.com. Or people are welcome to follow me on Instagram at MDLovesLP.
Excellent.
And you can learn about LP and even me and what I'm doing and what it's like to be as fortunate as me and have the wonderful job that I have. And just give me a follow.
Great. Well, thank you for taking the time. I do appreciate it.
My great pleasure. So cheers to you. Be well. Stay safe. And make sure to bring some enjoyment in your life. And I promise a little bit of champagne. Some Laurent Perrier will help with that.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Learn more by visiting laurentperrier.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Copyright 2020.